Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in Washington.
And I'm Ken Rudin in Concord, New Hampshire.
And I think that's going to demand some explanation. Ken, what are you doing up there?
Well, Helen Thomas said we should either go to Germany, Poland, or New Hampshire. And I picked New Hampshire. I thought that would be a good choice. Actually, that's not true. Talk of the Nation is in New Hampshire this week. We're doing not only the Political Junkies segment in Concord, but also we're a meeting and greeting generous givers to public radio, the wonderful people who keep us employed. The strange people who keep me employed, and that's why we're in New Hampshire, and a lot to talk about New Hampshire politics as well.
Absolutely. Generous givers. Ken, I want you to give both of them my best. So would you do this for me? Give me a quick rundown on the New Hampshire political scene. I guess the big one is the Senate race for Judd Gregg's seat.
Right. The primary is, of course, September 14th. And, of course, we already know the Democratic nominee. That's Congressman Paul Hodes. But there's many candidates on the Republican side running for the nomination. The establishment candidate. That's the key, because we've seen in the past the establishment candidates don't do too well, especially when they're facing conservative challengers in the Republican primary. And that could happen here. Kelly Ayotte, the former state attorney general, who was backed by the party leaders from day one. She's never run for office before. The attorney general in New Hampshire is an appointed position, and she's running, and she had been favored for the longest time. There's also, as we've seen in many states, there's a conservative alternative backed by Tea Party folks and conservatives. Ovid LaMontagne, if that name sounds familiar, and it doesn't.
Ovid does. Ovid, yes.
But if it did sound familiar, he ran in 1996, defeated the establishment choice in the 96 gubernatorial primary, and wound up losing to Gene Shaheen.
That's how we got Gene Shaheen in the governorship and later in the Senate.
That's right. So so that battle we've seen between establishment candidates and alternative conservative / Tea Party folks, it's playing again in New Hampshire.
Now, we should say that all or most of those Republican candidates, not all, lead Paul Hodes in the polls for the fall. Is that not right?
They do, and there's not much difference among all the Republican candidates. I mean, they all want to repeal health care. They all support the Arizona immigration bill, for example. There's no difference among the Republicans on that. But, for example, Ayotte, as attorney general, there was a financial resources mortgage company that had this Ponzi scheme that many people say that she didn't act on quickly enough or act on at all.
That sounds a bit like a substantive issue there, Ken.
Well, I don't mean to get away from personalities and talk about substance, but actually that seems to be the big issue with her chances on September 14th.
All right, and the governorship. The governorship, Democratic incumbent John Lynch has served 3 2-year terms, still running for a fourth, but the Republicans have not decided on their challenger.
That's true. That's also part of the primary. And also, John Lynch, it's an unprecedented fourth term that Lynch is trying to get. There was a recent Matt Rasmussen poll that showed Lynch perhaps vulnerable. And the reason I say perhaps is because Lynch has won re-election by over 70% in both 2006, 2008. They have 2-year terms here in New Hampshire. And I still suspect Lynch wins. But we talked about the big Democratic wave in New Hampshire, especially starting in 2006 when they won control of the state legislature for the first time since 1874 when Ron Elving and Dan Schor were doing their podcast. So it's been a long time. So the Republicans are hoping to get a comeback, and perhaps 2010 is their comeback year.
I understand. Now, two other races there, both the House seats. How do things look there?
Well, in the first congressional district, Carol Shea Porter is seeking re-election to a third term. There are 8 Republicans running against her in that one. And in the second congressional district, where Paul Hodes is giving up, Charlie Bass, the former congressman who was defeated by Hodes in 2006, is seeking a comeback. The chairman of the GOP, the state GOP here, is John Sununu, the former governor and the former Bush chief of staff. And he's kind of gotten the rank and file pretty excited here. So at least right now, June 2010, the Republicans feel they're on the march in New Hampshire.
Interesting to note that all this happening in New Hampshire, one of the states that has moved most notably from a hard right conservative bedrock Republican reputation to the center and then really to a blue state in recent elections, really a kind of a touchstone for the changes that have come in the 2000s, especially in 06 and 08. And now maybe moving back to the center, maybe moving back to the right. But let's talk about another state that certainly has emerged as a Republican bellwether and a Republican touchstone in recent years in a very different part of the country, South Carolina.
Well, both, if you look at presidential states, both are crucial. New Hampshire, of course, the first primary. South Carolina has always been the first Republican stronghold in the primary process for the presidential race. But there's a very bizarre spectacle going on with the Senate race there. And Alvin Green, who apparently won the June 8th Democratic primary for the Senate. And I say apparently because, well, first of all, you know, he had no staff. He had no advertising.
He had no campaign.
He had no campaign buttons.
He had no campaign website. And someone, well, he seems to have come up with $10,440. He says he saved it up from his military pay over the last couple of years. There's some reason to doubt that. And there is a hearing later this week in Columbia, South Carolina, of the 92-member Democratic Executive Committee to determine whether or not they think Alvin M. Green is in some sense or another a plant.
How does somebody who, by the way, Alvin Green, who was arrested on allegedly showing a college student pornographic materials back in November and couldn't afford a defense lawyer, how does somebody like that afford $10,440 for a filing fee? So a lot of people are talking about conspiracies, that the Republicans, it's a Republican plant, although I don't think Jim DeMint personally cared if he ran against Alvin Green or Vic Wall.
It doesn't make a lot of difference in November which of the Democrats Jim DeMint beats handily, but it is an interesting question against the background of a number of other allegations of dirty tricks and politicking.
And South Carolina is known for that, by the way.
Well, Lee Atwater and so on. There's quite a tradition in South Carolina. But let's also mention that next Tuesday, South Carolina has a runoff for the Republican nomination for governor.
Right. And that comes 2 weeks after Nikki Haley's very strong showing in the June 8th primary. She got 49%, just under what she needed to win the Republican nomination for governor outright to succeed the term limited and the adventurous Mark Sanford. The second candidate in that runoff is Gresham Barrett, the congressman. Perhaps if he had more time, Congressman Barrett could run ads talking about whether Haley is what the Republican Party wants, given the allegations that she had unacceptable physical contact with two men, not her husband. And so, but those charges did not stick. And matter of fact, Nikki Haley's numbers went up after those charges came out. And it looks like she should win the runoff pretty handily.
That looks like a done deal. But there are other runoffs on Tuesday from earlier primaries.
Right. And Bob Inglis is the one to watch. Bob Inglis is a congressman from the 4th Congressional District. Once upon a time, he was known as a strong, solid conservative.
Oh, he was one of the class of 1994, one of the foot soldiers in Newt Gingrich's revolution.
Absolutely. When he gave up his House seat to run against Fritz Hollings, I think it was 98, he was, again, considered really, really right-wing. And when he came back to Congress, he, like, did moderate things, like he voted for the TARP program, or he actually voted against the surge in Iraq. He also said about his South Carolina colleague, Joe Wilson, that he should apologize.
Joe Wilson for the "you lie" shouting.
So Inglis has been on the outs with conservatives, and he only got a 28% or so in the June 8th.
Really badly beaten up. It's very hard to see him recover.
And he's probably going to lose to Trey Gowdy, who, you know, the fact is he's just, Trey Gowdy is one of those not so much he's a Tea Party guy, but he's the kind of person, as we saw in Utah with Bob Bennett, who took some votes that the incumbent made and said this is not what the Republican Party stands for.
Including votes to bail out the banking system, things of that nature. All right, and in another runoff in South Carolina, this is one for the books. We have an African-American candidate on the Republican side named Tim Scott. If elected, he might be the only Republican African-American in Congress. And he's running against, of all people, the son of Strom Thurmond. Right. But the leadership of the House Republican Party has thrown in with Tim Scott largely. Many of the leaders of the National Republican Party in the House have thrown in behind Tim Scott, and they seem to be very eager to have him come join their ranks.
Absolutely. There's not been a black Republican in the House since J.C. Watts left in, I guess, 2002. Before that, it was Gary Franks in Connecticut. And before that, it was Oscar DePriest in Illinois in the 1930s. So, I mean, the fact that I could name the number of black Republicans in the House in history on my one hand just shows how the Republican Party would be very eager to see Tim Scott win on Tuesday.
Okay, please don't show us your other hand. And let's move on to North Carolina.
Well, North Carolina also has a runoff, again, as an establishment versus an outsider choice, although the outsider has been in office since 1996. The outsider is Elaine Marshall. She is the Secretary of State. She's been elected over and over again, but the party insiders wanted the outsider candidate, Cal Cunningham, for the nomination, but it looks like Elaine Marshall, who led in the initial May primary, is going to win the runoff as well.
This is a Blanche Lincoln kind of case, is it not? I think the loyalty of women voters turning out for Elaine Marshall is going to show us a little bit of what we saw in Arkansas with Blanche Lincoln.
Yeah, but the difference is there was deep anger directed from the left, from the unions, directed at Blanche Lincoln. I don't think there's any anger.
No, but it's a preference for an option over the woman candidate who could arguably be called the person who has either been there or been in line longest. And a lot of women turning out and saying, I don't want to see that happen.
Well, that could very well be the case. I think Marshall does win the runoff. And, of course, the Republican in November, Richard Burr, as with the Republican in Arkansas, John Bozeman, is favored to win in November.
And while we're in North Carolina, let me stop you right there, because we do have to mention this week the bizarre incident of Bob Etheridge being stopped on the Hill or accosted, in his words, by a mysterious camera person whose face we don't see on the gone viral video because it's been blurred out. And, you know, all of a sudden this is an Andrew Breitbart world, and it's everybody's sudden interest in Bob Etheridge. No one ever heard of him before. What's this all about?
The irony is that Bob Etheridge once was the Democratic dream candidate to run for the Senate against Richard Burr. But anyway, Bob Etheridge is walking down the street, Capitol Hill, and he's stopped by this cameraman, and he just says, "Hi, Congressman, how are you?" And then they say, "Do you fully support the Obama agenda?" Now, we don't know if there was some kind of editing going on in the process, but Etheridge just goes berserk. He grabs the cameraman by his wrist and then by his neck later and says, "Who are you? Who are you?" And then, of course, the kid says, "I'm just a student. I'm just doing a project." Now, who knows what motive the student had, but
the shadow knows.
Looking at the video,
it's a terrible video, but then on the other hand, one has no idea what has gone on with the video, although obviously Etheridge looks terrible, and Etheridge has apologized and said, "I shouldn't have ever done that, and that's a terrible thing for me to do." Are we now going to be able to expect many congressmen who are in competitive districts to, well, shall we say, attract a camera, attract a crowd?
Anybody who serves in public office or wants to serve in public office should be very wary of a camera facing him. We see it with Michael Moore. We see it with the guys with the Acorn video, you know, with the prostitute.
That is Andrew Breitbart, so we're in that world. On the other hand, Steve King saw nothing to apologize for after being on the Gordon Liddy show and referring to Steve King is a congressman. Republican congressman from Iowa, referring on Gordon Liddy's show to President Obama having a mechanism that breaks down race issues so that he would favor the black person. He saw nothing wrong with that remark and said that he saw no reason to apologize for it, although a number of his colleagues have rather moved away from him on the Group W bench.
And we've seen comments from Sharon Angle, the newly crowned Republican nominee for the Senate in Nevada against Harry Reid, talking about Second Amendment rights. And then she says, she's quoted as saying, "We should take Harry Reid out."
Is she volunteering to buy him dinner and maybe go to a movie?
Or, you know, or visit him in down the Appalachian Trail? I don't know what it
meant. Oh, no. What she means is she wants to take him out of the Senate.
Well, of course, that's what it means. But in a campaign where guns is an issue, where Tea Party anger is an issue, it seems a little discomforting.
Well, I'm glad that you and I, at least, are still getting along, Ken.
Well, I'd still like to take you out, though.
Sorry, I'm going steady. We've been talking a lot this week about House races, which is a little bit unusual, but one of the reasons we're really fascinated with House races this week is that NPR has just publicized a poll done by our bipartisan team of pollsters. That's Glenn Bolger from Public Opinion Strategies and Stan Greenberg from Greenberg, Quinlan and Rosner, a Democratic polling firm. This poll was not a national poll. This is what sets it apart from the things you see every day. This was a poll only in the 70 districts that most everyone would agree are the competitive districts for November 2010. These are the ones most likely to go from Democrat to Republican or Republican to Democrat. And no surprise, 60 of the 70 are currently Democratic seats and are in danger of going Republican, and only 10 are Republican in danger of going Democratic. In these 70 districts, they found that President Obama's approval level was notably worse than it was nationally, that people were accepting Republican statements written by Glenn Bolger regarding the major issues of the day, the economy, the oil spill, foreign policy, more than the Democratic statements written by Stan Greenberg. And generally speaking, considering that 60 out of 70 of these districts have Democratic representatives right now, this was a highly frightening poll for Democrats.
Well, I also think it's a very effective way of looking at the landscape for November. Go to these 70 swing districts where the balance of power, where the incumbent party could be switched in November, and find out what they have to say. And the fact is, when you look at these 70 districts and that voters in these 70 support Republicans over Democrats by a 49-41% margin, and that 54% of the people in these districts disapprove of the job that President Obama is doing, I think that's really significant. And as you say, could be big trouble for the Democrats in November. You know, we keep talking about wake-up calls for the Democrats. And when are the Democrats going to wake up?
Well, I think that the wake-up call thing is a little overused, because I don't think there's any Democrat out there who thinks that they're going to have a good year in 2010. I don't think there's any Democrat out there who hasn't awakened to these forces. The only question is degree. The only question is whether we're heading towards a tsunami or a large wave. And this is another poll to indicate that it's going to be a tsunami, that it's going to be 40 or 50 seats, which some Democrats are still saying, no, that couldn't happen. Now, when we're talking about these House districts and we're talking about those polls and how these 70 districts matter, doesn't mean that we disrespect the opinions of the people who live in the majority of the districts, the 350, 360 that we don't think are competitive. And their opinions certainly will matter in all their statewide races, and that includes Senate races. What's going on in New York, by the way, Ken? Some new polls out there. Did we lose Ken?
Oh, I'm sorry. I needed a wake-up call. Oh, I'm sorry. See, that was a little joke for the wake-up call.
No, I think we just took a vote here, and we all got it.
Oh, good, good. Well, it's interesting. If the Republicans had a pulse in New York, it might be interesting. The fact is, the latest polls show that both Charles Schumer, who's up for re-election, and Kirsten Gillibrand, the appointed senator, who is up for to fill the last 2 years of Hillary Clinton's Senate seat, both their job approval numbers have gone down. I mean, they're still overwhelmingly favored to win re-election. But again, had there been strong Republican candidates, and there are not in either contest, perhaps maybe Schumer or Gillibrand could have some kind of a contest, and there is no contest going on in New York despite dropping poll numbers.
Can't leave this week without talking about topic A, the thing that everyone has on their mind, which is oil, and the president bringing in the BP executives for a woodshed session in the White House, if that's really what happened. We didn't get to actually hear it. Ken, this was the president's first use of an Oval Office address. Did he choose his spot well? Was this the time to do it?
Well, what the irony here is that everybody was saying, President Obama's got to address this issue. The American people are angry. They're frustrated. They're angry at BP. They don't know if Washington can help. They don't know if government can help anymore. They need answers. So President Obama spoke to the nation from the Oval Office. And I don't think anything could have been accomplished as long as oil is still spilling out into the Gulf. You could say that we're doing the best we can, and I'll take my wrath out on BP. But ultimately, until the oil stops spilling out, until the landscape is cleaned up, which is going to take months, if not years, I don't think the president could accomplish what he needed to accomplish.
You know, there are so many contradictions here with the president going down for a couple of days on the Gulf and talking alternately about how great the beaches looked in most of the region and people really should come down and have their vacations there, and then also talking about the environmental destruction and damage. It's hard for people to get their heads around an issue like this, and I think we saw in the way he was 360 degrees criticized for his Oval Office address. The environmentalists didn't like it because there weren't enough specifics about his plan. There wasn't enough of a commitment to moving on to a completely different kind of system of energy. The oil-producing states didn't like it because they don't like the notion of a moratorium on deepwater drilling. All kinds of reasons for people to be unhappy with him. So it didn't have the intended effect of an Oval Office address, which is to bring the country together.
I agree with you completely, Ron. If this is one of the greatest environmental crises in history, and President Obama said this over and over again, where is a sign that government is doing what is supposed to be get done? And if the American people did not see it, then ultimately it was a wasted speech.
Ken, I don't want to interrupt you, but there seems to be some very dark and viscous liquid seeping into the studio right now from under this door, so I'm just going to have to say that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Loving you.